Hey y'all, today on Forensic Friday, we're going to talk about mummies. And I don't mean the plural of mama, but honest to goodness, Egyptian mummies and the process it took to embalm them in ancient Egypt.
Woohoo!
All the fascination the living had with them over the last couple hundred years, and forensic advances in the study of mummies over the years, and how that's allowed us to know even more than we ever wanted to know about the mummies. The West's fascination with mummies really started around the time of Napoleon and the Regency period in England. Napoleon's soldiers came back from their failed attempt to conquer Egypt with tall tales of the riches they saw there and the pyramids and the mummies. Fascinated and wealthy Europeans, especially the British, it seems, flocked to Egypt to get their own mummy and bring it home. They'd host unwrapping parties, Lark, in their homes, and they... Or they'd rent out a place, a town hall, and they'd sell tickets to come and see them unwrap the mummy if they wanted to make a little money from it.
Oh, my goodness. And now, we're coming up on Halloween, Kim. There's a plan.
I know, right?
Freaking party idea, girl.
Oh, well, I'll tell you about the mummy thing later.
Okay.
But one London surgeon, Dr. Augustus Granville, conducted a 6-week autopsy on his mummy. And we'll get to that in a few minutes, along with the scientific advancements which have helped in studying mummified remains. But first, let's talk about mummification. It was a very long process that took about 70 days to complete.
Wow.
It was not just for the rich. It wasn't for the very poor, but there were middle class and servants and people like that who actually could afford to be mummified, although the level of tchotchkes and things like that might have been a little lower class. But a lot of people got mummified. And
cool.
Mummification is basically a religious ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptians felt the deceased's body would be in their next life, so they needed to preserve it before they went on. Now, mummification was conducted by priests who were familiar not only with the rituals and prayers, but also very knowledgeable in human anatomy.
Mm.
When they got to their little body, the first thing they did was stick a hook up its nose and remove the brain bits by bit, because they didn't feel that the brain was necessary in the afterlife. They didn't think it was the essence of the person. So they just yanked that puppy out and got rid of it. They didn't even keep
through
it.
Through the nose.
Yep.
Think about that next time you have an allergy attack.
You won't sneeze your brains out. They got to use a hook. So they just didn't consider it essential. But they often ruin facial features with that hook, I guess, poking it through your nose and things like that.
True, true.
When they didn't mean to. Then they made a cut on the left side of your abdomen and removed all the soft tissues like the liver and lungs and intestines and stomach and things like that. But
wow, they did know all about the body.
Yeah. And they could do it through an incision. But they left the heart inside the body. They didn't touch it because they felt like the heart was the center of the person, where their memories and their intelligence were stored. So they thought it was essential to have the heart in the afterlife in order to have a soul, basically.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Now, the remaining organs were dried and placed into containers called canopic jars.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were really ornate and made of materials like alabaster, just really dependent on how wealthy you are, the nicer the jars were. And later on, and for people who didn't have as much money, they put the organs in packets and put them back inside the body, but they would still have the jars so that I guess you could have them in the afterlife when you came back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. They may have put other things, offerings, oils, things like that, that they felt were essential in the afterlife. Now, the rest of the body was packed with a special salt called natron, and that dried things up pretty quickly, dried out all the fluids in your body so that the tissues all got compact and tight and dried out like jerky, basically. They put packets of the natron inside the body cavities to help speed up the drying. And I'm kind of seeing those little packets of silica that you get inside inside your Haribo gummy bears, you know?
Oh, my God. They were so far ahead of their time. It was incredible.
They keep your gummy bears from getting gooey instead of gummy. So, you know, they they were
getting dry.
They were keeping the body dry instead of it getting gooey.
I love it. Next time you eat a gummy bear, you think about that.
Think about
too.
This mummy, man. And
gummy mummies. I love, there's a title.
Hey, that would be a great Halloween candy, gummy mummies.
I know.
I wonder if
gummy
they have
mummies.
Them.
Wow. I bet they do. I bet they do.
Once the body was completely dried, the salt was washed away and the packets were removed. And the result of having those packets inside the body while it was drying in the abdomen was that the abdomen didn't sink down like you see sometimes in a body that's discovered somewhere. The organs kind of disintegrate and the abdomen of the dead body will sink down sometimes. And this actually kept the tissues extended while the mummy was drying, and it remained lifelike and in kind of a relatively reasonable human form that way.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Like stuffing it with cotton, sort of.
Yeah, pretty much, except it helped it dry out too. Then those yards and yards of linen were used to wrap the body, and sometimes as much as 100 yards, I think, of linen. Used to wrap the body sometimes.
Wow, do you know how expensive that would be?
Now, but you know, they kind of made it, so.
true, but somebody had to make it and sell it, you know.
They sometimes even wrapped the fingers and toes individually before they wrapped the hands and the feet because they wanted to keep the mummy as intact as possible as, you know, it went over time. Now, they put...
That's very loving.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was loving or if it was just tradition and they felt like they had to do it or the person wouldn't make it over to the... the other side, you know.
Okay.
Inside the layers and layers of linen, they would put sometimes things like amulets and tokens like shabti, which were the little, sometimes lapis lazuli or sometimes other kind of precious stones, carved deities. And they would wrap them up in between the layers in case the person needed magical assistance to get to the afterlife. Mm-hmm. They would be there to help them. The Egyptians believed that the mummified body was the place where the soul or spirit resided. And if the body was destroyed, the soul or the spirit, the essence, what they felt was the essence of the person, would get lost and not be able to find their way back. There were three spirits involved. The Ka, the Ba, and the Ak. The Ka was the mummy, the physical form of the person before they died or, you know, after they're desiccated and dried out. And it would remain in the tomb and needed offerings and things like that. They would put precious oils and scents and sometimes pets and servants that they killed along with them. So they'd have somebody to wait on them in the afterlife. They would kill their closest, you know, like their, or
then
whatever.
They mummify them too, right? The cats and the dogs.
The cats, the dogs. They mummified all kinds of things. They mummified ox. They mummified gazelles and baboons. And they mummified all kinds of things. But the Ka was the physical form and it was left in there with offerings and objects. The Ba, or the soul, was free to leave, they felt. It could come and go as it pleased anytime. And the Ak, which was the spirit of the person, traveled through the underworld to the final judgment and to go to the afterlife. So to the Egyptians, all three were essential in order for them to move on and then, I guess, be reincarnated. Now, let's go back to all that excitement about finding mummies during Regency England. And there were other places. There were other places across Europe as well. But the British seemed to have a particular liking to mummies and Egyptology. And they studied Egyptology quite a lot. And they have the British Museum has the most complete Egyptian exhibits outside of Cairo. And a lot of those mummies they have came from the people that got these mummies back then. And that's really where my interests were when I was working on this story because I'm a big Regency England buff.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, some people would have elaborate parties, big get-togethers with their friends and everybody to unwrap their mummies, or they'd sell tickets. But one corpse, which was dated to 600 BC, had been removed from the necropolis of Thebes by a young explorer called Archibald Edmondstone.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know what to do with the mummy after he got it, so he gave it over to our Dr. Granville to study. Now, Granville had a lengthy 6-week autopsy on this mummy and discovered that it was female and approximately 50 years old, and he figured she had a few kids and gotten fat and died of ovarian cancer. He did find a tumor inside her about the size of an orange.
Wow.
He also declared that she had been preserved in beeswax and bitumen, which is basically asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
But later they found that wasn't really true. But he did manage to scrape off enough wax. I'm hoping it was wax anyway. To light some candles all around her and put her on display and went over his findings to a packed house.
You mean he scraped off the gooey off of her and used it to light her up?
He didn't light her. Yeah, put candles. He made it into candles. Yeah, made it into candles and put them all around her while he talked to this packed house of researchers, of science folks.
Oh, that's so twisted, Jace. That needs to be in your book, which we'll talk about in a little bit, too.
Now, later, he kind of regretted what he'd done. He felt like he'd destroyed something that was sacred, and he should have left it alone all along, but, you know.
Yeah, well, after he counted his dosh, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that he got paid for any of this. I think he really did it for the pure research of it all. I think he was that interested in how mummies were preserved, and, you know, he really wanted to know what she died from, since she was relatively, 50's not really that young for that time, but, you know, I think he really did it for scientific knowledge, and then later felt like he maybe shouldn't have, because it had been a sacred burial, and he felt like he had violated that in a way. Now,
having some buyer's remorse, was he?
Yeah, I think he was. I think he was a little bit.
Okay.
Now, as time went on, the study became a little easier because X-rays were invented in Germany, right? So we didn't need to unwrap the mummies really anymore. We could get an idea of what was on inside of the package with an X-ray. And this was right before the second mummy craze. Do you remember what that was?
The second mummy craze.
Of the 1920s.
Oh, yeah, because they like to dress like that and stuff, yeah.
It was
the jewelry and stuff.
Yeah, it's when the Art Deco period started to get popular. Yeah. It was when King Tut was discovered, when the Valley of the Kings was discovered. They thought at the time they had found all the mummies, but they hadn't. There was still the Valley of the Kings. And when they discovered that in 1922, and they found King Tut's tomb, they still couldn't. They could get X-rays to see what was going on inside the package, inside the wrapped body, but they really couldn't get the fine details. Like, was it a broken bone from an accident, or did it happen during the mummification process? Because they kind of sometimes had to get a little rough, you know, depending on how long the body had been around, to get that mummification process going. Now, in the British Museum, which I mentioned earlier, has the largest collection outside of Egypt, took possession of that mummy, of Granville's mummy. And she lay collecting dust until the 1980s, when she was discovered by accident in a chest in a storage room. Now,
Indiana Jones.
Yeah. Now, as you can imagine, between 1922 and 1980s, there'd been huge advances made in X-rays. And by that time, we had something called a CAT scan, right? CT scan.
Yeah.
Now, when she was first studied in 1821, the scientists, you know, Granville decided that she had been pretty hefty and she'd had a few kids and she died of ovarian cancer. Now, that wasn't quite right. She did, in fact, have an orange-sized tumor in her body, and it wasn't ovarian cancer, but it was a benign ovarian cancer. It wasn't malignant. And so they studied more of her bones and her tissues, her liver, her gallbladder, actually, and her bone tissue, and realized through some of the DNA they were finding that she actually died of tuberculosis, because they found DNA from the tuberculosis bacteria in her lung tissue and those other parts of her body as well.
Now, for her having tuberculosis, doesn't that isn't ever go dormant, does it? So could they have still breathed that and caught it from her?
I don't think so. I would think that the bacteria were desiccated at this point. Now, I guess if they had reconstituted the bacteria, if that had worked. I mean, that's not that easy to do. But I don't know, to be honest. I'm doubting it, though. I don't think they would have reconstituted and been infectious at that point. So anyway, they started doing CT scans now. And with the CT scans, they can literally take visual slices of the corpse, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
And then they can reassemble it virtually in a computer to see what's inside the wrappings. They can tell you if they might have died of a heart attack from clogged arteries. They can use those virtual images, and they can lift off the bandages to study the muscles beneath. And then they can study the bones beneath the muscles virtually by using CT scans.
That's amazing.
And they can sometimes determine if the deceased was a victim of a homicide. They can see where knife wounds might have penetrated and left marks or nicks on bone or in tissue. They can even tell if a person may have died from septicemia from having severe dental issues. So everybody, boys and girls, go get your teeth cleaned. Get your teeth checked.
Because
you can die from infections from a bad tooth. So, you know, it happens.
And it hurts your heart too.
Yeah, it's not good for your heart or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes if during the mummification process. And these are things they can see with x-rays too. They can tell if the embalmers needed to fit them with prosthetics, with like a fake leg, a wooden leg or something like that, so they'd be whole in the afterlife. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if they looked a little thin, they would pad the corpse with linen to make its shape back the way it was before. So if they were a little tubby and they got a little thin during the desiccation process, they just pad them back up before they wrapped them so they'd look the same.
Works for me.
Yeah, there was a guy, a temple doorkeeper from Thebes who lived around 700 BC, and he suffered the ultimate indignity. I'm saying this from the research that I did, that his head fell off during the embalming process.
Oh, no.
And so in an attempt to make him whole again, the embalmers stuck his head back on with a couple of poles.
Uh-oh.
So they had to do things like that.
And since.
Yeah, I'm sure there have been all kinds of things, and I probably don't really want to know some of the things they've done to make bodies look right. Mm-hmm. And like I said before, they sometimes embalmed animals that were important to the gods, I guess as kind of offerings to the gods, and they would stick them in the tomb with them. Things like oxen and falcons and cats and birds and baboons and gazelles and this and that and the other. So, and people, if they thought they needed a servant in the afterlife, Helena would just have to sacrifice herself and go to the afterlife, whether she liked it or not.
Somehow I doubt she would willingly, but you never know.
You never know. You never know. Now, I mentioned earlier canopic jars, and these were basically anywhere from small to pretty large jars, and they came in sets of four, and they were intended to keep specific organs inside for the afterlife. Now, one held the lungs, one held the intestines, one held the stomach, and the fourth one held the liver. And each one was represented by one of Horus's sons, as well as a goddess. The lungs jar was a baboon head. The intestines jar was a falcon head. Mm-hmm. The stomach was in a jar was a jackal's head. And the liver jar has a human head. So those are the four jars of baboon, a falcon, a jackal, and a human that are put in with the mummy.
So they go into the mummy too?
They don't go in the mummy. They go into a chest
beside
the mummy. I got you. So they are there with the mummy, but they're beside the mummy, I guess, in case he decides to look for his intestines in the afterlife. They've been dried out. They dry them out before they put them in the jars. So they've also been dried just like the body was. So that's my lesson on mummies today, boys and girls.
Well, hey, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Never can get enough of mummies, especially with Halloween coming up.
I know, right? So.
I'm telling y'all, we're going to have an unwrapping party, so stay tuned.
Oh, yeah, I meant to tell you that story. I used to live next door to a stuntman when I lived in L.A.
Do tell.
And one Halloween, you know, the previous Halloween, I'd had like hundreds of little kids at my door, so I ran out of candy, basically, and had to send...
Kim and I adore Halloween, let's just say that.
I had to send my then-boyfriend, now my husband, out to get more candy because I was running out. Then rolls around the next year, and the stuntman moves in next door, and I bought all this candy, you know, to give away because I had hundreds of kids the year before. Well, I was wondering why my doorbell wasn't ringing. Uh-uh. So I go and I look outside, and he's standing there, stock still, completely wrapped like a mummy. And I watched, and what happened was every time a kid would come up to the front step, they would think he was a statue standing there, right, or some kind of pop. And he would jump out after them, and they would take off running the other direction. So I never got any trick-or-treaters to my door that year.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
anyway.
I'm sure the candy didn't go to waste, but what a fun guy.
Yeah, really. Alrighty, that's it for today.
I think we'll see y'all on Tuesday. Alrighty. Thanks for stopping by. Thanks, Kim.
Bye, guys.
Bye, y'all.